I remember many years ago that the comedian David Brenner had a routine that began with him walking into a post office and seeing a poster that said, "No dogs allowed except for seeing eye dogs." And then he would say, "Who's supposed to read that poster?" And you realize that generally, our conception of blindness is there is this visual field that presents itself, but the person who is blind can't see it. So everybody who could read the poster didn't need to, and the person who needed to couldn't. And it's exactly the reverse, or at least I assumed it was until this week, with the plague that we read about in this morning's parsha, which is the plague of darkness. There, we assume that the blindness comes from God's having blotted out the visual field. You can't see anything because it's dark. And by some miracle, the Israelites can see. They can see through the darkness by whatever magic of illumination God allows for the Israelites that God does not allow for the Egyptians. But I was reading a Torah commentary by Rabbi Mark Angel, who is a Sephardic rabbi on the East Coast, who's published a bunch of books and writes a Torah commentary, and he brings the comment of a 19th century Sephardic rabbi named Yitzhak Samuel Reggio, who says, actually, God didn't spread darkness over the whole land. God made it so that the Egyptians couldn't see, which is a completely different way of thinking about the plague, true or not. That is, the problem wasn't with the visual field. The problem was with the Egyptians' eyes. And it got me to thinking the extent to which the Torah, which is after all really a book about what people hear, Shema, listen. God reveals a word, a voice. It got me to thinking the extent to which the Torah is also about what we see and what we don't see. How does Moses become Moses? He's walking along, and there is this bush that is burning, but it's not consumed. That is, it isn't turning to ashes. And Moses says, I have to turn aside and look at this, because this is remarkable. And then the Torah says, when God saw that Moses turned aside to look, God called out to him, Moses, Moses. So the rabbis, noting that, said, the bush had been on fire for a long time. But only Moses noticed, only Moses looked. And that's why God chose him, because Moses wasn't blind to the wonders of the world. I remember a colleague of mine, Larry Kushner, saying once he was sitting by his fireplace and he was looking at a log turned to ashes, and he realized how carefully and long you have to notice whether something that is burning is actually turning to ash. He said Moses couldn't have just glanced at that bush, he had to really look. And yet in our lives, it isn't just that we don't look, that we are flooded. Our visual field has so much to see that we find it hard to actually pay attention to anything in particular, to any person, to any phenomenon. But even when we do look, we are blinded. One of the hot books now that Rabbi Angel actually mentions in his talk is that of the only psychologist to win the Nobel Prize for Economics, Daniel Kahneman, who along with Amos Tversky, his colleague, wrote a book about all the ways in which we get things wrong. And one of them is something he calls the illusion of validity, which I think might more accurately be called thinking too much of yourself. The illusion of validity is whenever you hear a statistic that reinforces your view, it somehow sinks in. But when you hear something that contradicts your view, you dismiss it. We see this in action in politics all the time. It's not as though the other side doesn't actually have some facts, some statistics, some arguments that support it, whether you're liberal or conservative. But if you are on one side resolutely, then the facts and arguments that support the other side are not things to be learned from, they're things to be refuted. because it's a battle, not a search for truth. And that's the illusion of validity. Whatever they say, they're wrong. And when you hear something that reinforces your view, it just makes it deeper and more certain, just like the Egyptians. If they weren't so certain, they wouldn't have lived through all those plagues without letting the Israelites go. At some point, someone would have said, "This doesn't seem to be working." But progressively, with each plague, there was an explanation, as there always is when we get contrary evidence, why this plague was an anomaly, or it'll go away, or it's not really about the Jews, or God will turn his attention somewhere else, or our gods will eventually combat this. You can imagine the average Egyptian as he sits around the table and is asked by his child, "Why don't we just let them go already, Daddy?" Explaining from the point of view of a mature and sophisticated slave owner why that's really a bad idea. And if you think that's far-fetched, then all you have to do is read the history of slavery in this country, where you will see elaborate, well-reasoned, repeated arguments from intelligent and otherwise compassionate people about why slavery is a good thing. And remember, it wasn't an argument that ended it, it was a war. And in miniature, we do the same thing in our lives. We don't like to be challenged, and we don't like to be changed. But there is, at least in this plague, one way out. Because after the plague of darkness hits, remarkably enough, the Torah says, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the eyes of Pharaoh's servants and the eyes of his people. That is, Pharaoh's people. So all of a sudden, people who literally couldn't see, once their eyes were opened after the darkness, in their eyes, Moses was great. Which tells you something about the value of darkness and confusion. And that's really what I think the plague comes to teach us, is that darkness and confusion and perplexity are good and to be valued. Because in your life, if you have difficulty and you have darkness and you have confusion, there is this powerful impulse to just get out of it and get a solution. But sometimes it upends your assumptions, changes the way you look at things, makes things different, and in the end, as with the Egyptians, can sometimes make things clearer. In other words, unlike the other plagues, the ninth plague, the darkness, was a favor. God was doing them one last service to try to make things clear before Makat Bechorot, before the killing of the firstborn, before the terrible, awful, murderous end to slavery in Egypt. He said, if none of these signs will convince them, then maybe if I plunge them into darkness, if they understand that they can't see, if they realize that all of their assumptions are mistaken, maybe it will cause a reevaluation of their lives and their priorities. It didn't work, but it was a good try, and it might work for us. When the Israelites come out of Egypt and they go to Mount Sinai and God reveals the Torah, it says, "Veroim et hakolot." The Israelites saw the voices. And we all know that you can't see voices. But what the rabbis say is, the effect in the Israelites' lives of the voices they heard were visible. You could see them. Because by now, the Israelites had been trained how to see. The idea of darkness, of questioning, of perplexity, of wonder, of uncertainty, these are things we instinctively shrink from. We don't want to be uncertain. We want to know. And yet, it is in unknowing sometimes that we come to truth. So, let's take a cue from the plague of darkness and wish for a little bit of that plague in our lives. The darkness that allows us to understand that there are things we don't understand. That allows us to be uncertain of our certainties. That reminds us that the only perfect knowledge is God's knowledge. And although we walk in darkness, that's good. Because only when you're in darkness do you search for light. Shabbat shalom. Shabbat shalom.